This is Al Williams, the African American Historical and Cultural Society. I'm here today with Rhonda McGee, professor at the University of San Francisco Law School, James Taylor, professor at the University, professor of Political Science at the University of San Francisco, and John Templeton, a historian. We're here to talk about the exodus of several hundred African Americans from San Francisco to Victoria, British Columbia in 1858. I want to explore some of the history of those events and some of the implications of those events and how they relate to contemporary circumstances. So I want to start off asking each of you to make a brief comment on the topic. Starting with Rhonda.
Yes, hi, thank you. To me, this topic is of seminal importance as it helps give us a sense of what Black Americans in the state of California and in the Bay Area contributed to the settlement of this area and the circumstances which gave rise to their migration, their out-migration, their having to leave or feeling they needed to leave the Bay Area. I think many people don't know these stories. Many people don't know about this history. So I really feel very grateful that the Historical Society is putting some attention to this issue. I'm particularly concerned to sort of help participate in the education around the way in which the law contributed to that exodus by coming down hard on the settlers who were here, imposing rules, regulations, and codes that were gradually increasing the pressure on the Black community here and creating an environment that was so discriminatory and in many ways oppressive that this area that had at first been a beacon of hope and a sort of a place where freedom might have been found turned out to be not the case, not that sort of place of respite, and therefore ended up being just a stopover on the way to another place that was sought as another stopping place for rest, Victoria, British Columbia.
Stopover. It's a good reference. Professor Taylor.
Yeah, I think when you sort of put this sort of phenomena in context and realize that in the 19th century, the mid-19th century, there were African Americans across the board making movement out of America and across the country. Exodusting is what some people called it, moving over into Indian Territory, or as it was called in the Oklahoma region. But even more so, you had movements through the organized institutions in the Negro Convention movement, which meant repeatedly trying to sort of, you know, parse out strategies for Black people as laws like the 1850 fugitive, the 1850 compromise, which had a component in it that was known as the Fugitive Slave Clause. You had the Kansas-Nebraska Act 4 years later. You had a number of events that unfolded throughout the 1850s, including the publication of Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. You had someone like Martin Delaney organizing and mobilizing, trying to find a way for African Americans to both, I think, in one way proselytize their religion of Christianity around the world with this sense of obligation to mission, but also the sort of push of racism throughout the country. And I think what we see here in California is an expression of that very phenomena, the ways in which Black Californians who helped establish and settle this territory found themselves suddenly being pushed out by these very same laws, even though this was a free state. These laws were used and sort of coalesced with the explicitly racist laws that allowed any Black person in California who was free to suddenly be subject to slavery again. And in important ways, the movement of these African-American people in the 1850s and 1858, specifically from San Francisco to Victoria, British Columbia, I think is a part of a larger narrative. It's a subtext to a much larger experience that Black people were trying all kinds of ways to dealing with the problem of race and racism in America at this time.
John Templeton, Professor McGee mentioned that referenced San Francisco as like this kind of beacon, this kind of shining light on the hill, as they say, and certainly today it's viewed in contemporarily as this very liberal, welcoming kind of place. What's your take on the existing circumstances for Black people? What were those circumstances back in 1858, and how do you see that causing, contributing to that exodus?
One of the themes that's present throughout the history of San Francisco is that it was a sanctuary. It was a place where people came who couldn't do things other places. That's not only the case for African Americans, but lots of other people. And even today, if you ask people who are getting off the plane to San Francisco, they say, well, you know, I just couldn't be myself someplace else. So this was true for African Americans in the 1830s, 1840s, like William Leidesdorf, who left Louisiana after he couldn't pursue his dreams because he was African American. And it was true in the 1850s for people who came from New England and from the Caribbean to participate in the Underground Railroad. So the exodus is actually a function of how successful they were, because it happens almost very soon after African Americans in San Francisco sent $30,000 to fund John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. So, you know, there wasn't just heat on them for no reason. They had basically participated in the event that touched off the Civil War. So what we have to do is see this in the context of things like Proposition 209 and the exodus that's happening now of African Americans the last 6 years. We've got 400,000 fewer African Americans in California than we should have had in 2006. And so we're able to show the relationship between the impact of a Prop 209 and, you know, what happened with the Right of Testimony Act and the Possessory Act in the 1850s, so that as we talk to young people, you know, I was just looking at statistics, only 3% of African American students in California are proficient in social sciences, according to the state test. So if you don't understand history, if you don't understand civics, if you don't understand economics, guess what? You can't participate in society, because all these decisions are being made, you know, that address these issues. So it's really an opportunity for us to show young people that these things that they think are esoteric, they matter. They make a difference in whether you can actually stay in this town. And so one of the things that's interesting about the people on this exodus were they were extremely literate. They were extremely effective in legislation and advocacy. And the strategies that they use to make a difference in California are strategies that people could be using right now, but because they don't know the history, they're not empowered to take advantage of it. So it's as Professor McGee said, it's a real opportunity not just to talk about the black folks who left, but what they did before they left, and also the people who remain here, because, you know, one of our scheduled activities is to go to the church that they left from, which is First AME Zion, which is still here after 156 years. Mm-hmm. So the leaving was not an ending, but it was just a chapter in an ongoing saga.
Right. Let me. You mentioned the right to testify. Mm-hmm. I believe it's, yeah. Is that the correct
term? Right of testimony.
Right of testimony. And Professor McGee, would you talk a little bit about that? What was
yes.
that?
Yes.
What were those laws, and what were the circumstances around?
Right. Yes. Well, in 1852, in fact, the California legislature had passed the Fugitive Slave Act, which stated that in no trial or hearing under this particular act shall the testimony of such alleged fugitives be admitted in evidence. And what that reduces to, in practical terms, is that this law prohibited the testimony of blacks who might have been in a position to testify, put into evidence circumstances that would explain that they had been free and that they were no longer subject to re-enslavement by folks who would otherwise claim that they were escaped slaves and therefore should be brought back into slavery. So if you think about it, here we have a community of people who've come to California. They have either, you know, maybe they were never even born into slavery. Maybe they had no slave narrative in their own experience. Or perhaps they had escaped slavery. Whatever their particular circumstance, they actually were now, by virtue of this act, much more vulnerable to being either re-enslaved or brought into slavery for the first time because they could not, under the law, testify in a way that could have protected themselves against any white man or woman, but any white who would come along and say, this is, you know, this particular individual who appears to be a free black is actually you know, my former slave, and I'm going to try and take him back to a slave territory, as an example. So the act had, it was a law that had a profound effect in terms of creating a heightened sense of vulnerability amongst the population here. And I mean, if we can imagine it, if any one of us could imagine that situation where somebody could come along and, you know, just by pointing at us and saying, that was my slave, by virtue of their testimony, make you or I vulnerable to now being put under conditions that would amount to perpetual servitude and virtual imprisonment in your skin in a so-called free country. I mean, that was just, you know, again, you can imagine what sort of hysteria, in fact, what sort of insecurity bordering on ultimately maybe hysteria might have been engendered in a population that would be subject to that kind of law.
I thought that, you know, the idea of California and its coming into the Union and being a part of the Union, it was supposed to be a free state as opposed to a slave state. But sounds, what were the politics, Professor Taylor, you know, of California's entry and how does this play out? It sounds more like a southern state.
Yeah, I can't remember which state came in with California, but at the time of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, it really was to undo what was seen by the Jeffersonian or the sort of revolutionary generation as a disastrous legislation. That was the 1820 Missouri Compromise that established slavery below the 36-30 parallel. And you come up, fast forward to the 1854 Kansas-Nebraska Act, you see these twin states coming in to the Union. And California, I can't remember its twin state that came in the Union with it, but California came in as a free state, nominally free as we see. And I think you can't underestimate the power as Brother Templeton has made clear, of the literacy of these black folk that left and went to Canada, the ways in which I think the 1857 ruling of Dred Scott, which many people, as Professor McGee can confirm, considered the most disastrous adjudication of law at the Supreme Court level in American history, or one of them, and how that resounded amongst black people at that time, and the ways in which it was a great incentive to leave very soon after, because it basically nationalized slavery as a national institution and told black people, regardless of your condition or your station in life, you are not free in America.
This is the Dred Scott decision.
Yes.
Okay.
Just a year before. So I think that was a very important sort of bookending of a process that is about 30 years old, beginning with, really, to be quite frank with you, and I talked about this recently, at the law school, the ways in which the 1787 Northwest Ordinance, the founding generation, the founding fathers themselves, created this whole idea of a divided nation along the lines of where Illinois and Michigan, Ohio, Indiana are, to allow slavery below those territories. And this
would you clarify that a little bit, to amplify 1787
Northwest Ordinance what did basically actually allowed slavery not to exist in those territories that are Ohio, that are Indiana, that are Illinois, that are Michigan, and anything below was subject to slavery if those states, those new territories so chose to be. And in fact, the actual language of the 1787 Northwest Ordinance, literally, with the exception of a few phrases, a single phrase actually, becomes the basis on which the 13th Amendment, that reads, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall be permitted in the United States or territory subject to its jurisdictions, except for punishment for crime that a person has been duly convicted of. The Northwest Ordinance really just substituted the word the United States for the word, I think it was, these territories. So it actually becomes the blueprint on which slavery is abolished, ironically, and at the same time it cordons off a portion of the United States as it was, I guess at this point known, to allow slavery below the Ohio, I think it was east of the Ohio River, and basically going all the way up to the border of Canada. And so this was what the founding fathers created. Mm-hmm. And then the Missouri Compromise in 1820 simply updates it. And then the 1850 Kansas-Nebraska Act updates it again. And then we find the Dred Scott case was basically the death knell for many black people that it was time to leave America.
Right, because that Dred Scott opinion explicitly states that the that there are no rights that a black man has in America.
That's right.
That the white man is bound to respect, mm-hmm. that the government is bound to respect, whether slave or free. And this is 1857. So if you're sitting in San Francisco and you're learning from the standpoint of the Supreme Court of that of this new free nation, there is no entitlement to protection of your rights as a free black person anywhere in this country now. Hmm. That, as I think Professor Taylor really usefully connects us up to where we are when we look at the 1858 situation, a year before the Supreme Court has said no rights that we're going to protect, and then a year later, they are saying here in California, we need to leave.
And one of the migrations...
John Templeton.
Yeah, one of the migrations that we need to connect this in is that, as was pointed out, California was a prize. You know, California became a state without first becoming a territory. Mm-hmm. So there was like a gap of 2,000 miles between California and the next state. And the difference was California had gold. So the fact that it was created as a free state meant that there was a jockeying to actually fill it up. So when California became part of the United States, there were 15,000 non-indigenous people and 175,000 Native Americans. So the ultimate disposition of California depended on who populated. Mm. So over the 1850s, you had a large influx of Southern whites who came to California. Mm. So its abolitionist movement, folks like John Fremont, you know, who were Union supporters, by the end of the 1850s, Southern sympathizers had taken over the state government of California. And so part of how we saw that was in the vigilante committees, the committees of vigilance that operated in San Francisco. And a lot of the actual violence that was perpetrated against not only African Americans, but Chinese and Latin Americans in San Francisco was done through these extra legal groups called the Committees of Vigilance. But the people who led these committees of vigilance actually became elected officials, senators and governors and that sort of thing. So a lot of what the blacks were responding to was the actual physical violence that they were facing, partially because African Americans, and part of what we'll learn as we, you know, hear more about the Exodus, was African Americans were probably the most successful business people in downtown San Francisco. Mm. So when you go take the tour, you'll see that people like Mifflin Gibbs and Peter Lester, you know, all up and down Clay Street, all up and down Washington Street were black businesses. Mm. And you would, you know, I mean, you know, what we now think of was the financial district was akin to what we would have envisioned on Fillmore Street in the 1850s. And so a lot of the, and this is a trend that happened, you know, in the 1900s in Tulsa, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So throughout American history, whenever African Americans have been economically successful, mm-hmm. it has sparked a response in terms of violence, in terms mm-hmm. of changing mm-hmm. laws and all that sort of thing. And so this exodus is really a response to another movement of white Southerners mm-hmm. into the Bay Area. And part of the story is that even though a significant number of African Americans left, those who remained allied themselves with white folks like William Tecumseh Sherman, who was a banker here in San Francisco. And a lot of those whites were able to align themselves with the national government mm-hmm. and keep California in the Union.
Well, let me slow you down for a second, John, because I want to go back to something you said. You talked about the presence in the financial district in Blackside. One of the thoughts that occurred to me, it sounds almost like folks got up and packed up and overnight left. And if they left, were they property owners at
yes.
the time? Did they own the property? And what happened to their property? And it goes to a point that Professor McGee has talked about when we've talked about the slavery ordinance and you know, the question of reparations and were they ever compensated for the taking of their land, and just what happened there? First, a short answer on were they property owners and what happened there, and maybe Professor McGee can talk a little bit about the legal.
Well, absolutely, and in the 1855 Colored Convention, they actually had a census of the property that blacks owned in every county in California. And blacks owned $2 million in property in 1855 in California. Mm-hmm. Now, William Alexander Leidesdorff, who was the largest landowner in San Francisco, he owned $1.4 million himself when he died in 1848. Mm-hmm. Now, part of the consequence of the Right of Testimony Act, he lost his estate because his mother was black and they wouldn't allow her to testify in the probate case. And so that's why John Folsom wound up getting the entire Leidesdorff estate for $50,000. So that the town is called Folsom was actually William Leidesdorff's ranch.
Right, but I was just saying, so that wasn't all in San Francisco.
Yeah.
He owned property outside.
Well this doesn't count as part of that $2 million because that happened before then, but my point is that when you look at Leidesdorff, when you look at the people involved in Exodus, when you look at Maryland Pleasant, when you look at the Pico brothers in Southern California, in every case, African Americans were literally had their property taken from them just by either the change of a law or the interpretation of a law. You know, Pico owned 532,000.
Okay, well, let's let Professor McGee speak to the issue about the legal implications there, and what does that say? Particularly pertinent in some regards to the legal, I mean, to the real estate situation today and what's
Absolutely.
Happening in communities. A lot of people impacted by this lending situation, mm-hmm. African Americans losing their property and their homes.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very, very, to me, interesting and in some ways illuminating set of facts for us to look at. From a legal standpoint, we know the claims for reparations, the lawsuits for reparations, the movement for reparations certainly dates back to the colonial era and certainly the running up all the way through and intersecting with the Civil War and area in that time post. And so what we're talking about in terms of potential reparational claims, I mean, these are claims that have been raised repeatedly from various points throughout history. But they've always fallen on relatively deaf ears in the courts, largely because of these sorts of legal disabilities, similar to what we see in terms of the Testimony Act. I mean, you know, blacks were not allowed to bring lawsuits, testify, sit on juries, and so on and so forth. And so even where the law was facially neutral to in some of these respects, as a practical matter, these lawsuits, frankly, couldn't have been brought up until very recent times, the sort of post 1965 wave of what we many of us call kind of second Reconstruction laws and changes in public policy that made gave birth really to the first wave of real quasi freedom, mm-hmm. you might say, for blacks in this country. So we had to wait until the 60s before many of the legal disabilities of bringing these sorts of claims could ever have been, as a practical matter, no longer a barrier. Now that we are in an era where those legal disabilities, at least from a technical standpoint, are not as viable, that is, we can testify, we can bring these cases. Unfortunately, there are statutes of limitations, sorts of arguments, the length of time then. So a new set of legal barriers.
Right.
Again, facially neutral, but they have, as a practical matter, cut off the viability of many of the legal claims.
Okay.
I do think it's really important and worth pointing out, though, the ways in which this experience and these experiences are precursors, the experiences of Black Americans in this regard, are precursors to the experiences of other communities of color in California and across the country in terms of being, you know, sort of the target of a virulent anti-community campaign, a discrimination campaign, hate crime campaign that would ultimately close opportunities in that area for those community members. So we know more about the Chinese American experience around this. They too were victims of that Testimony Act.
Right.
So we have examples, and that was one of the, again, the run-ups to the Exclusion Acts in California. Started with the law as well in that regard. And losing land, losing property. We saw that happen to Chinese Americans. Certainly we saw it with Japanese Americans in the Internment Act. So, and Native Americans, it's obvious. Mexican Americans at that same period in the middle of the 19th century were also, again, had these large parcels of land similar to that that Leidsdorf had gotten from the Mexican government, taken from them by virtue of legal process. So it's I think this 1858 exodus gives us a really important opportunity to sit with the truth of all of our history around this and tell some, you know, untold stories about who we were as a country, who we were as a state, as a new state, as a young country in the middle of the 19th century, in ways that help flesh out for us why we are where we are today,
right.
Our community, the Black community, and other communities of color as well.
Mm-hmm. Professor Taylor, let me ask you, we've talked a lot about the legal, the inability of Blacks to testify in court. But as I understand it also, Blacks were without the franchise at that time. Blacks couldn't vote either. So from a political standpoint, can you talk a little bit about those implications and how they did or did not contribute to the inability to affect laws that would have given the right of franchise? Were the numbers significant enough to make a difference, or did it make a difference one way or the other?
No, not at this point in African American history. I mean, we're talking about, you know, the 15th Amendment had not really been sort of given any teeth, and that's in the 1870s.
And the 15th Amendment?
Which is giving African American men the right to vote, not even African American women.
Okay.
And of course we know it's not implemented for another 95 years, of course, Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement. So you're going backwards in time. There were pockets of places in the South where African Americans might have been able to participate in the political process under the Brown and Tan the Brown and Tan Republicans that sort of emerged kind of quickly, but this is still after. This is in the 1860s. So prior to this time, you really don't have a fulcrum where African Americans are able to exercise the right to vote in the East, where there were large numbers, and even less so, to my knowledge, here in the West. And I don't know if John knows more specifically about that.
Well, part of the irony about African Americans deciding to leave in 1858 is that it was only 12 years after the last two Mexican governors of Alta California were African Americans. And the largest, as she mentioned, the land grants. You know, 2 million acres of land grants that were owned by Afro-Californians, Afro-Mexicans.
But those governors were appointed by Mexico.
The Mexican government.
By the Mexican government.
California,
so it wasn't
part of Mexico before the Mexican War. So you didn't have racial designations in California under Mexican law. And so you first had the taking of land from the Blacks who were already here, who spoke Spanish. Then you had another group of Blacks who came out to be part of the Underground Railroad. They were able to, they turned the right of testimony and the Franchise Act to their advantage, because all the people who had so-called rights went up into gold country and were able to do gold claims. Well, the African Americans and the Chinese realized that, you know, they couldn't hold on to their property, so they decided to stay back in the port and run the businesses and make money. And so it took 4 or 5 years before there was a backlash against that. So part of what is a lesson for today's people is to look at a group of people in the same way that African American became governor of New York today, but he's blind.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so even with the disabilities and not having the right testimony, not having the right to vote, the African Americans who were here, most, and these were people who had just come out of slavery, who didn't have formal educations, but they still wrote petitions to the California Assembly. They wrote articles in newspapers. There are probably more letters to the editor in San Francisco newspapers in the 1850s than you have today by African Americans. And so they were able to work through other groups to actually overturn the Right of Testimony Act by 1864. So it is an object lesson in how you can work through a situation that's outwardly very damaging to you.
Well, let me just, John, lest we leave folks with the impressions that those African American, the people of African descent here, were all very, or you mentioned they were well educated and very enlightened people, and I certainly don't take issue with that. But am I not correct in my understanding they were all mostly relegated to subservient kinds of positions and jobs, and kind of, while there were business people, that's to be sure, but there were significant numbers who were
porters
and yeah, provided service, house cleaning, and worked in the homes of whites and that kind of thing. They were not all affluent people.
They weren't. Yeah, I mean, even if you look at $2 million in property, if you divide it by 5,000 people, it's still not a lot of money, but compared to African Americans elsewhere in the country, it was a fairly significant sum. But what maximized it was that they used it in a concerted way, and this is why the churches were so important and the protective of society. The first African American bank in the United States was created in San Francisco in 1857. So they came out here with a purpose in mind to use their relative freedom in San Francisco to end slavery.
Okay.
So everything they did, if they were digging a ditch, they were digging a ditch so they could make some money to contribute toward ending slavery. So,
well, that's kind of like for generations.
Yeah,
I mean, we all grew up with the notion that we had a responsibility to contribute to the uplift of African-American people. I did a speech a couple of weeks ago, and I said in there that, there was never a question about my motivations for going to college or doing what I did. It wasn't about me and my success. And I said the greatest honor that could be paid to me is when I die, they put on my tombstone, he was a race man.
Mm-hmm.
That is it, that he was committed to uplifting the race. Now, Professor Taylor, as you know, we've got a number of programs we're going to be doing in commemoration of this event. During the week of April 20th, we're looking at April 20th for some kind of symposium at First AME, which is 100 church here, First AME Zion, 150 years old. It's a place where a lot of these conversations took place about leaving the city. On the 22nd, we're going to be doing a program down at the Port of San Francisco with a reception. And on the 25th, John is going to be hosting a forum looking at the context statement for identifying historic facilities or buildings, places in San Francisco. So we're commemorating this event. This is not a celebration of black people leaving San Francisco, but by the same token, it's not something we're holding our heads down about. It's a historic event that we want to commemorate. What is it that we hope that you think people should look to learn and get and gain from this commemoration that helps us as we move forward?
I think it's very important, for me at least, to understand and to sort of convey that this movement of people was not sort of derived out of a certain ideology that black people had generated per se. I mean, we think about American Colonization Society, which was an early 19th century society created by the likes of Judge Bushrod Washington, the nephew of George Washington, Henry Clay was a powerful senator from Kentucky. Francis Scott Key, who wrote the Star Spangled Banner. Everyone from Thomas Jefferson to Abraham Lincoln all supported this idea of, you know, of colonizing African Americans out of the United States by any means necessary. And then there were African Americans like Martin Delaney, like Henry Highland Garnett, and others before and after, who also generated the idea affirmatively on their own that they wanted on their own terms to leave the United States or and to go to Canada or Liberia or to Haiti or Latin America on their own terms. And they had these very different agendas and very different plans. And I think it's important to understand that these folk that left in 1858 did this out of their own. I mean, there was a racist push, no doubt. But they also, I think, had an affirmative commitment on their own to preserve a sense of community that that is a powerful sort of, I think, presage in some ways. And I don't know how people here in the, in San Francisco sort of in the African American community sort of read this, but clearly there is some connection, I think, even today in the 20th century that just passed on. Of what happened in the events in Guyana, and the ways in which there has constantly been a struggle of African Americans in this city to make this place their home, and there have been constant sort of legal and sort of developmental sort of urban renewal agenda that have made black people's presence here very uncomfortable, and I think Guyana is largely, in some ways, the great tragedy that sort of explains a lot of what the discomfort for African Americans has been in the city of San Francisco and in the state of California, and in some ways is confirmed in the constant pattern we see. As many people know, this is one of the only large cities in America where its African American population is actually in decline. And it seems like from 1858 to the 1970s here into the 2000 census and more recent, that there's always been this sort of pattern that we see throughout this experience.
You know, I think you used the term powerful, and I that was the term that was in my mind as you were speaking. As I sit down and think about this, and, you know, how does a group? It couldn't have been. I mean, the numbers. My estimate, and this is not scientific. My estimates were there may be 450, 500 people or so, black people in San Francisco at the time. So for a couple of hundred to leave, that's a huge, huge number. And to do that on an affirmative decision to leave, I'm going, how do you come to that? How do they come to that place of making that decision to pack up and get out of Dodge in that affirmative way? And you know, it was rough, but it wasn't like people were chasing them out of town with shotguns. They decided, no, this ain't it, and we're going to get out of here.
But part of this.
Hold on, just one second, John. Okay. I'm gonna come back to you. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
But part of what helps make it sense is that there was also a gold rush in British Columbia,
right?
That they were going to. Okay. So by going to British Columbia, they had an opportunity not to just sell to the people who dug gold, but the opportunity to actually be gold miners themselves. So that was part of the positive lure to actually go up there and be part of the factors of production. So
there's a pragmatic side to it.
So it helps explain, because the other, you know, as we sit here and talk, I mean, you know, we're going to study the people who went, but the real question is, what about the people
who
stayed?
Yeah, what happened to the people who stayed?
So I think there are all kinds of facets to it, you know, because the people who stayed, you know, continue to make a positive impact, and their legacy is still here in the 356-year-old black churches that are here. And so one of the things that we should research is, by their leaving, since we knew black folks sent money back to the South from San Francisco when they were here, did the people who went to Victoria, British Columbia, send money back to the people in San Francisco so that they could deal with the situations here? Because there's a high level of what we call in social science agency in this. You know, and so often African Americans are described in history as just pawns, just part of the backdrop, where we even mention it all. It's like, you know, two groups of white folks had the Civil War, mm-hmm. you know, and, mm-hmm. and black folks were just right. kind of on the right. sideline. They were the ones that there's freedom at stake. Right. They left it up to other folks to decide right. whether they're going to be right. free or not. Right. But what we're learning in the history of African Americans in early San Francisco is how deliberately, you know, African Americans set out as a national organization and statewide organizations to address the primary issues that were affecting them. Mm-hmm. And so it's that sense of agency that we have to convey in talking about the exodus, because rather than people just kind of leaving San Francisco in a scattered way, mm-hmm. as happens now, mm-hmm. you know, we can draw a lesson, mm-hmm. you know, from what they did in the 1858, because of the way they left when the Civil War was over, they were able to come back.
Yeah, yeah. Another point you highlight there, John, in terms of thinking about the situation, thinking about who left, mm-hmm. another part of the conversation needs to be had is thinking about who were the people who were here that contributed to the climate and mm-hmm. the context and environment that made them leave. Who were the people who were pushing that legislation mm-hmm. at the state? Who were the people who were taking those actions? And as has been suggested a lot, there are a lot of streets named around San Francisco, a lot of buildings and public facilities mm-hmm. named at honoring people mm-hmm. who were really contributory mm-hmm. to the climate and circumstances mm-hmm. that caused black people to feel the need mm-hmm. to leave in the first place in that part. Let me wrap up this with one final question to both of you, and it's a little bit off topic, but it's an interesting one. And that has to do with the fact, the recent revelation of the letters, Lincoln's letters, in which, I guess as I understand it, he proposed to buy the freedom of all the slaves for $400 apiece, feeling that the cumulative cost would have been significantly less than it would have been to wage the war, which again presents it in an economic context, an economic issue. Are you familiar with that article?
Yeah, it goes back to Jefferson. Jefferson, in the Notes on the State of Virginia, came up with numerical formulas and a strategy of gradual out-migration of black people that would cost a certain amount per child. The children would go after their parents. And again, you have to keep in mind that the idea was to export all of the free black people out of the country and to preserve, in order to preserve slavery back east. And this again happens with with James Madison, comes up with a similar mathematical formula. And then Abraham Lincoln, again, through this American Colonization Society, comes up with this sort of equation as to how we can do this. And as recently as the presidential campaign of 2008, we saw at least one person, this Ron Paul from Texas, mm-hmm. Talk about the ways in which, of course he was mistaken and said that Abraham Lincoln started the Civil War, but he also talked about the ways in which out of all the European powers that engaged in the slavery regime, it was only the United States and North America that actually had to engage in war, civil war, in order to end its slavery, and that most of the other countries, and mainly I think the British, actually purchased their slaves from the slaveholding classes and then manumitted them or, mm-hmm. or freed them. And so I guess this was what Abraham Lincoln had a desire to do, but I don't think Abraham Lincoln can appreciate something that I think Cornel West brings out very beautifully in his book, Prophesied Deliverance, where he talks about the contextual situation of black Americans, the ways in which like black Americans, South Africans, and the Aborigine of Australia are all people who continue as we speak to be locked in a national body with the very people, the descendants of the very people that enslaved them, and that is a particular predicament that is not experienced, for example, by the Africans in the Caribbean, mm-hmm. or Africans in Brazil, or Africans in, say, Haiti. In most of those cases, the whites that came and occupied those lands and enslaved those peoples went back to their European lands and allowed the African people in their, you know, with the stuff that was left to them to build their lives and build their cultures and resuscitate themselves, whereas African Americans and the black South Africans and I think the Aborigine were locked, stopped, and in barrel and bound by law in a national body with the very people who had impressed them, and as a consequence, it became, I think, an undue burden is what Cornel West seems to suggest that African Americans had to deal with, that most other African people in the diaspora did not have to sort of contend with after the mid-19th centuries when the Brits freed blacks in the Caribbean in 1833 and the French soon thereafter. You know, black Americans had to contend with this for another 30 years, and after that, for the next, 170 years as we are alive now, continue to be locked in a national body with the descendants of those same peoples. And I think that's a particular predicament of African Americans as we try to make a way out of no way today.
I think part of what's important about San Francisco is that this was a group that actually forced Lincoln's hand. And by aligning itself with whites like John Brown, causing him to go to Harper's Ferry. But you also, as we research this, we will also find out the links between the black churches and people like the Crockers, Stanford, Mark Hopkins. These were all subscribers to Frederick Douglass's paper. Okay? And it was working. The biggest impact of blacks in San Francisco was actually the impact that they had on whites like Thomas Starr King, who were able to actually actualize the things that blacks wanted to happen. And part of what is distinctive about the Exodus and also about the whole history of African Americans in California during that period was that this was probably one of the few places in the country where they were able to deal with their white allies on a basis of equality and to really make things happen. So it really magnifies the importance of what happened in San Francisco because it really changed the course of history.
Wow. Well, listen, thank you all very much for this. It's been a very stimulating and enlightening conversation. Again, historian John Templeton, Professor James Taylor, Professor of Political Science of the University of San Francisco, and Professor Rhonda McGee, who is a professor at the Law School at the University of San Francisco. This is Al Williams at the San Francisco African American Historical and Cultural Society. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For more information about the commemoration of the Exodus, the 1858 Exodus from San Francisco to Victoria, B.C., check us out on the website at www.sfexodus.com.